This is Ted Price, CEO and founder of Insomniac Games. And recently, on behalf of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, I had the privilege to interview Herman Holst, who is the managing director of Guerrilla Games. What was most fun for me about the interview was discussing our shared history. What Herman and I were able to share were many anecdotes from early on in the PlayStation 2 and PlayStation 3 days, where we were both experiencing the same challenges. It was really interesting for me to hear how Herman and Guerrilla had made the transition from a big first-person shooter franchise like Killzone to an absolutely massive open-world game such as Horizon Zero Dawn. It was refreshing and educational to hear about Herman's perspective on creative culture, on his team, and transparency, and how they foster creativity within their teams.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
My name is Ted Price, and I am here with one of my great friends in the industry, Herman Holst, who is the managing director of Guerrilla Games. Herman, thank you.
Well, it's so awesome to be here with you in Cascais, Portugal. It's not really work, is it?
Well, we like to tell everybody it's work, right?
Okay, let's keep it with that.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk a little bit about history, because I remember years ago when you put out a game called Killzone. We at Insomniac looked at it with envy, and I personally was really impressed with the art. So one of the things I heard you say today was how important attention to detail is and how that's been a theme for you from the first Killzone all the way through Horizon Zero Dawn. How do you make that really connect with everybody at Guerrilla?
I think attention to detail, that's been part of the studio philosophy, and it's been part of the studio's core strength at Guerrilla. I think when we started out and we made Killzone, the game, the success it had was largely based on the quality of the graphics, which again was driven by the technology that we had in-house. And we had, with Killzone 1, a lot to learn when it comes to game design, when it comes to narration, for instance. But the graphics and the technology behind it have always been strong. So what we've tried to do as a studio was maintain those key strengths and then build on top of it, kind of remove your weaknesses, if you will.
Well, do you, when new people join Guerrilla, do you talk about the importance of, say, the artistic detail in your characters? For example, I remember looking at your soldiers, the Hellghast, in Killzone, and thinking to myself, the level of detail you have with the ambient occlusion and the shaders and just and the normal maps was incredible. And it made the game appear like it was on a platform that was more advanced than what we were looking at the time.
I think it's actually a layer deeper probably than just talking about it. It's embedded in how the organization is designed. For instance, a lot of teams have a concept team. We have a visual design department, right? There's a lot of the name where we have staff that really are industrial designers that come up with these incredible, for instance, character designs and machine designs, bot designs, where their philosophy has always been try to make it look as if it actually could be created. And when you start with great concept work like that, I think the people that that translate that into 3D and eventually animate it and make it interactive, they build on that. And it's also the people that you have, our art director, studio art director, JB Van Beek. He is known for his relentless drive when it comes to attention to detail. And because we've been successful on the back of that, we've always tried to kind of embrace it. And, you know, it can be expensive, for instance, but, you know, if that's one of your strengths, you better not lose it.
Well, it definitely shows in everything you've done. In fact, I also remember those of us at Insomniac when we were working on Resistance, dissecting your weapons nonstop. I mean, whether it was the look of the weapons or the reload animations, which were incredible. And it's funny that that something like a reload animation can gain such importance. But as somebody who was making first-person shooters, for us, it created a personality for each of the weapons and sort of a feel for the game that we didn't see in any other first-person shooters. So I think it sounds to me like that attention to detail was far more than just the artistic attention to detail. It went into your animations. It went into the way you set your scenes, etc.
That's very true. I mean, that Killzone became known for its very visceral feel, its mm-hmm. visceral combat, super intense, and that's created by very detailed animations, such as reload animations, and that defines the personality of a game.
Yeah.
But you know, you guys were looking at how we develop games and. That vice versa, that was just as interesting for us, because when we were working, I believe that was Killzone 2, I think that was pretty much at the same time as Insomniac worked on Resistance Fall of Man.
Right.
And at the time, so we knew we had really great graphics and good technology, but for instance, your production management discipline, just the sheer discipline that you guys had of adhering to schedules and getting a game out in such a relatively short time, that again was a huge inspiration for Guerrilla Games. We looked at that and said, how is this possible? Like, it takes us 5 years and these guys took 2.5-3 years to make Resistance Fall of Man.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because we didn't have a choice. We were a launch title for the platform.
Right.
And so we were going to release that game on a certain date, whether we liked it or not. So being up against that wall was in some ways an inspiration and in some ways a really harsh motivator for us.
The fact that you guys were able to do that post Killzone 2, we actually set out as a studio goal to learn to be very disciplined, to really professionalize when it comes to production management and deliver these games. So we set out a 2 year and 0 month dev cycle for Killzone 3, because that's something that we needed to learn, and that's largely inspired by your development cycle on Resistance Fall of Man, because we were just, you know, making exclusive shooters for the same platform at the same time. So of course you're going to look at each other and inspire each other. That's one of the great things, I think, about, you know, having these kind of conversations, comparing notes. I love it.
Well, that is true, and I appreciate you saying that. I also remember you coming over to visit us and sharing your approach to, I think it was your mocap. We were at that time starting to evaluate some mocap suits, and you guys had been pioneering mocap in your games with these mocap suits, and we got some great advice from your guys on that. And I think you gave us a lot of advice on destruction as well. We were trying to implement destruction in Resistance, and you guys had killed it on Killzone with destruction. And you'd done it in some really clever and cheap ways, but it looked really, as you said before, visceral and believable. And it was super cool to have you guys say, hey, here's how we do it. And I was surprised, just like your speech today here at DICE Europe, you opened the kimono. You were able to say freely, hey, just check out how we do it. We're really happy to share our approach. Now, do you do that with lots of other developers? Is that something you guys are...
I think as a studio, Team Guerrilla's always been fairly open about our development practices and about, you know, what motivates us. And you're right, on Killzone 2, one of the project goals was that demolition of the environment. I recall putting out as a goal in front of the team that every bullet needed to have an impact, and we took that quite literally. And I like it when you come to these kind of conferences, where DICE here, where you share as much as you can in terms of the strategy that you have, to how you motivate your team, to maybe showing some work in progress. My idea, my thinking is that if I do it, then other people will do it as well, and it's just beneficial for the industry in its entirety.
I agree with that. And I thought today in particular, when you were talking about your approach to collaboration and consensus on design, was really interesting and different, especially for a studio of your size. You have a large studio, a lot of people contributing to design. How do you manage the creative collisions that inevitably occur when you are trying to create consensus around a particular design?
There's always a time for going wide and harvesting ideas from everybody, and then at some point making choices. And I think it's you constantly have to be aware and sensible when you're going to reach out and include everybody, versus going top down and say, well, now we're actually going to have to make some tough choices. Mm. But I think particularly in the early stages of a project, there really isn't any good reason to not involve everybody. It's kind of bad practice to not do it, because you might miss out on some really great stuff, really great great insights, great ideas that your staff might have. And everybody's creative. You know, programmers can be super creative. They come up with great gameplay ideas as well. I think where it can go wrong is to keep going for too long, because it's if you don't want to be in a brainstorming process for 4 months, because people get tired of that. You need to be very disciplined. You need to have relatively small groups. You need to have set goals, defined space and defined process to do it. And you need to probably have some sort of opt-in, opt-out process. Many people like it, but it shouldn't be mandatory, because yeah. People don't like to be forced to brainstorm. But many people that do want to participate, they really don't like it when you pass them.
Is there a point, though, in every project where you start cutting down on the amount of brainstorming? Is there a specific point that you reach and you say, okay, guys, brainstorming is over, now let's just focus on getting the game finished? Or do you continue that brainstorming process for features throughout the entire game?
I generally don't believe in best practices, because all projects are so different.
Okay.
So when you embark on a Horizon Zero Dawn, it's a brand new IP, it's a first open world game, it's got a very different tone, a very different look and feel than anything Guerrilla Games had done before. Your exploration goes super wide. You need to invent so many different things. And now that we're, for instance, working on an expansion for Horizon Zero Dawn that's coming out later this year, your staff will have a lot of experience with the core mechanics, so that the nature of that brainstorming is very different. It's much more to the point. It's more informed and more educated. So it can be more goal-oriented, and it can be probably shorter. Also, we obviously have less time for that. So I think in all situations, you need to have a good look at what it is that you're trying to get out of it.
Okay. Well, so let's say you're brainstorming for the next expansion. You know what the game is. You're familiar with the mechanics. When you get ideas that you feel don't measure up, that aren't pushing things far enough, how do you deal with that? How do you encourage people to go further than what you were doing before?
So generally, you just have to be honest with people. If something is not a good idea, then people understand it. You just got to explain it to them. Sometimes if there has been a session for a week and there's been a multidisciplinary group that's had a task of coming up with new ideas in a particular field, sometimes that just wasn't mature enough, and you need to do a 2.0 of that effort. So sometimes it's just more love, more time. Sometimes it's just a dead end and it's not going to happen, because maybe you had already looked at it the previous game. There were really good reasons not to. My experience is honesty that will last with the team.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I feel like at Insomniac as well, that's what people appreciate. The moment you try to hide something from the team is the moment that you lose people's trust.
Yeah, if you tell them that was great and then you leave it there and you're not going to do anything with it, that's really bad practice.
Exactly. Yeah. We're all professionals, right? And I think right. That's we have to treat each other like that. Well, I want to go back to both the start of Horizon Zero Dawn and the start of your new expansion. And I will tell you, one of the challenges that we have at Insomniac is pre-production in general. Coming up with an IP idea is hard enough, and then figuring out how to get to production is another journey altogether. How, if you had to go back and go through the pre-production process on Horizon Zero Dawn again, what would you do differently to make it even better?
This is one of those super tough questions. Many things in hindsight actually worked out really well. In hindsight, I would probably drive towards the integrated core combat experience even more rigorously. So try to nail that. And maybe I would always say that. But it took us a fairly long time. It took us up until E3 of 2015, having worked on it for several years then, by then, before we had our first very good-looking combat experience against a Thunderjaw. And it actually took us until 2016, so the game came out in February, March 2017, before the combat experience was robust enough to put it in the hands of non-developers. So clearly, fighting machines, you know, that's the heart and soul of Horizon Zero Dawn. That is something that I think that would have been great to nail that a year or even longer earlier.
That's a really good, I think, solution. We feel the same way too. I mean, those core mechanics and getting that feel of what it's like to do that thing that you're going to be doing again and again, getting that feel right is so important and drives everything. But one thing that you did that you showed today, I was really impressed by, was your rip-o-matic. And I hope lots of people get to see that, because for me, what that did that most of our games miss at the very beginning was it set the tone. You understood, looking at this piece that had been constructed from a lot of found art and some art that you had created with the team, set the table for what the IP is. And I know that it's often very difficult to have a big team understand what the vision is early on. And I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that helped streamline your pre-production a bit.
I don't know about streamline, but it's, I think the goal for Horizon Zero Dawn was clear from the start. If you look at that rip-o-matic, the way the game ended up feeling, the general sense of machines against this juxtaposition of technology versus nature, of primitive versus high-tech, all of these elements were there in a way that that made it clear to people what it was, what it is that you're making. And probably the single large frustration on a development team is not knowing what the creative direction is.
Yes.
If you do a survey on a development team, when people are unhappy, is what is it? Then the game director probably needs to clarify what exactly it is that they're making. With this particular game, with Horizon Zero Dawn, we had that rip-o-matic, and we had some early vision that wasn't very detailed. So some of the stuff that I showed today, a lot of the individual features fell off or were replaced. But the overall, the general feel of what it was that we were making, the premises, the core pillars of the game, I believe have been intact in their full integrity.
That's really impressive. I think that's rare. I don't know if that's been your experience, but I know in our experience, it's often that the pillars change or evolve because the vision wasn't clearly explained, or maybe we came up with a better vision along the way. But the fact that you kept it consistent for the entirety of development is fantastic.
Which I believe is an argument to start kind of narrow on a development cycle. You really want to get this right before you roll on a huge production team. So we spend about 3 years with only 20, 25 people, which, you know, to some indie studio that might be expensive, but we, and so are you, we're in the business of having, you know, 200 plus people on a big title sometimes. Having 10% of that buys you the time to experiment and to get that initial vision clear and well communicated.
Yeah.
And I think that's for us, that is something that we've learned on this process, that we'll probably do that again.
That's great. Well, I tell you, I hope we can do it for our next project, because I certainly took inspiration from what I saw there. Well, and it's funny, taking a step back even further, you also mentioned that you guys were working on the early concept and you saw Enslaved, basically.
Yes.
I found that really fascinating, because we had almost exactly the same experience on Sunset Overdrive. We were concepting Sunset Overdrive for the Xbox One, and I happened to be going down to G4 to do an interview, and Cliff Bleszinski was there doing an interview on Fortnite. And I was in the green room, and I watched Cliff describe Fortnite, which was almost exactly what we were doing for Sunset
right
Overdrive.
You.
And I talked to Cliff afterwards, and I said, "What's up with that? How did you know that we were making this game?" He said, "I had no idea you guys were making this game."
Great clearly, minds think alike, Dan.
Well, yeah, he was saying we were clearly influenced by the same cultural touch points. And I went back to our team, and I said, "Guess what, guys? We're competing with Epic with Sunset Overdrive. Maybe we should start thinking about something different." And so we actually came up with a completely separate IP called Birthright, and we're moving in that direction. And then we ended up switching back to Sunset Overdrive. And I want to know a little bit about your inspiration for coming back to Horizon after it sounded like you had been changing gears or switching gears to another IP.
Yeah, we so we did this. So after we completed Killzone 3, we set out, we essentially created a brief for all of Team Guerrilla, and about 40 people pitched. So very different ideas, hardly any straight shooters out there. Also some shooters actually, but the majority was, which is very wide diversity. And one of the pitches was by our studio art director, JB, was Horizon. And so we felt great. And then, you know, that story you just told of Enslaved, Odyssey to the West came out, and we actually parked that, and we didn't know how big that was going to be. We just saw that, you know, machines, beautiful nature, a female lead, robots, all of that was in there. So to us, that felt like it would really kind of take the wind out of our sails creatively. Mm-hmm. And we actually parked it for a while, and we took a step back and we went broader. So what we did is we took note of some of the greatest common denominators in these various pitches that staff had had done for our director team. And we set up two task groups, and we actually looked at, we created another pitch that I showed you today. And even though that was great and it made a lot of sense, the goosebumps that I felt when JB pitched that original or presented that original pitch of Horizon to me, I couldn't forget about it. It is sometimes you have a gut instinct that tells you, however different it is and however tough that challenge is going to be, you have to do it. And Horizon, I think it turned out to be one of those things where we felt we had to do it.
That's very similar to the thinking process we went through. I remember calling Drew Murray and Marcus Smith, who are the creative directors on Sunset Overdrive and also had come up with Birthright, meeting with them and saying, guys, what do you really want to do? What are you passionate about? What's the team passionate about? And it was clear. It was Sunset Overdrive all the way. And they didn't care, and the team didn't care. I didn't care really if we were going to go head-to-head with Fortnite, because ultimately it came down to, what are we passionate about? What does the team believe in? And that really has to be generally the answer we use when we're coming up with IP and deciding what to do.
And I mean, you say it in one sentence, you know, what the team really wants to do, but it's often underestimated how big an advantage it is when the team is fully behind a project.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's when, you know, on a development cycle, to the non-developers, you know, even a very, very fluent development cycle, you will have 5, 6, 7 moments where you hit rock bottom and it doesn't work, or your publisher doesn't believe in what you're doing, or it might be that your core combat experience we just talked about, that might not be coming together too quickly. And if you have a team that just really wants to make it because they feel it's right, at the end of the day, that's actually going to pull you through all of these complicated situations. And it's something that I've learned on this project too. I don't think Guerrilla would easily do a title without taking stock of what it is that motivates people.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, speaking of that, how do you, in the depths of production, when things are the most difficult, ensure that everybody still feels ownership of what they're doing? Because as we all know, when you are looking at a massive list of bugs that you have to get done, features that haven't been finished, maybe even missions that have to be redone, it's very easy to just think about the task at hand and not the passion or the fact that you have control, creative control, over what it is that you're doing. How do you keep that fire lit in the depths of production?
I think generally, particularly when they're working against a bug list, they're too busy to play the game. Mm. Especially then, probably carve out a Friday afternoon to make people play the game. Yeah. So they have the context of their work. That's really important. But we do this weekly or bi-weekly update meetings. And you get people like your narrative director in front of the team and explain to them how this is going to be great, particularly parts of the game that haven't been fully developed yet. So that can really help just providing the context of the individual pieces. People need to see the bigger picture. And sometimes when you're early on in development, working towards an integrated deliverable that's being presented at a show can really help.
Absolutely.
Right? That's kind of a cheeky development strategy. But once you've been at E3 and once the world sees that, you know, this is going to be amazing, sometimes it's actually more motivating if they hear it from their peers inside the industry but outside of Guerrilla Games than it is hearing it from me. Right? Of course, I'm going to say it's going to be amazing.
I'm nodding fervently here.
Yeah,
so, yeah. I completely.
So you got to go out there sometimes and announce a game so people are aware of it, because it can be tough when you're working on a project for 2 years and you can't really tell anybody about it. People don't know about it. You're working in isolation. Sometimes you need to be out there.
And sometimes the only feedback you're getting is from focus tests or usability tests, and that isn't always the most positive feedback. But when you can go out to the Guerrilla fans or the Insomniac fans and say, look, here's the new thing that we're working on, and the response is positive, there's nothing like it.
Exactly.
It definitely provides that sort of mid-project boost that everybody needs to get to the finish line.
That's exactly it. It's worked magic on this project when we did our premise movie. I think it was in 2015 when the game was announced. That was a huge boost to the team.
I remember that. I remember looking at it and going, well, I remember your first released trailer and thinking, that is awesome. I cannot wait to play that.
Yeah, it was a magical moment for the team.
Yeah. Well, it was different. I mean, that was what was so cool. It was unexpected, because as your studio is known for a specific type of game, and when you put that out with the color and with the robots and the main character, I think everybody in the industry took a step back and went, wait, this is Guerrilla?
These guys? Are they going to do this?
Yeah, no, it was awesome.
Can they pull it off?
And you delivered. Well, let me dive back into a more technical question and a problem that we tend to struggle with at Insomniac. Given the size of a game like Horizon, do you feel it's best to build up everything sort of equally, take all of the areas and sort of build them up to a certain level, or focus on one specific area and bring it to finish before you hit the rest of the areas of the game?
That's a really good question. So this is Horizon Zero Dawn is an open world game.
Right.
And open world games, I think, are made inherently different than a more linear experience. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to say to build your world and then, you know, script your gameplay into it. Very different than making a Killzone game. So creating that world is something that we did a lot earlier in relative terms compared to our more linear experiences in the Killzone series.
But when you did that, when you created your open world or sections of it, did you bring any of them to quote-unquote final with the technology you had at the time?
No, for a long time we actually had two tracks. We had the world itself, and then we had benchmark art. So it was important to figure out how far we could push this goal that we set, creating, you know, BBC, Planet Earth, nature, documentary, great, fully dramatic, natural beauty. We wanted to achieve that, but we couldn't do that in a deliverable that was the same as where the gameplay lived in. So we set out a separate track and proved that out. So it was a very narrow, separate track. We had machine combat test grounds, for instance, where you know, these machines that we're creating are, you know, some of them are super complex. They might have up to 12 different interactive combat components in them. So you're not really going to try that out and test it out in a scripted sequence or in a particular quest. So we actually worked for a very long time on this project with separate tracks on art, on core combat. We were prototyping, and actually that started much later because we didn't have the team, right? We'd never had quest designers or the narrative designers. That started later, but that was also a separate track in a way. And fairly late did everything come together. Now, I'm not suggesting that is good practice. That is by necessity, because again, we didn't have some of these disciplines in place. But generally at Guerrilla, I know that at the end of the day, our artists can make the game look good, and the effects will be looking good. So on a game this different from anything we've done before, nailing the core combat and forcing ourselves perhaps to do that in isolation from some of the other project goals, that probably was the wise thing to do to pull that forward.
Well, let me ask you sort of a loaded question. Was it difficult to judge fun factor without having the final art and final effects in for the robots and your weapons?
I mean, it always helps when things look good.
Yeah.
But I believe early on we knew that the combat was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Let me phrase that differently. Many of us, the game director, the experienced people, the lead designers, knew that we were set up for something good.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes for the wider team, it helped when we had that layer of visual polish on top of it.
So how did you decide to unveil the combat to that wider team? Did you wait until you actually had all of the effects and final art in?
Frankly, we probably had a year where we really needed the team to bear with us.
Yeah. You know,
we needed, and at this point it helps when you have some veterans in the industry that have a lot of a good reputation. And we have Matthijs de Jong, has been our game director for a long time. He did pretty much all Killzones. At the end of the day, when I'm working with him, many people on the team will trust that he's going to nail the combat.
Yeah.
We're talking about attention to detail. He's got that, and it just sometimes it requires time. So you need to give your creative leads the benefit of the doubt, and vice versa. You try to pull the demonstration of quality as far forward as you can, to not kind of stretch that period where your team is going to have to take a leap of faith. But sometimes development can be harsh. There is that phase,
and you have to convince everybody that, hey, it's going to be okay, guys. We actually believe at all levels that this is going to be fun.
Exactly.
Yeah. We especially when you're doing a new IP, that's one of the toughest things to actually prove to yourself and to your team.
Yep.
Without everything being final. So let me take a step away from the actual production process and just ask about you personally. You've been running Guerrilla for a long time, and what is your day-to-day activity like? Are you spending a lot of time managing? Are you diving into design? What are you doing?
So that really depends on the phase of a project. So the last 4 months of the project, I basically was with Matthijs, our game director, in our cinema, playing the game with him, and working through the feedback with him. There is a phase in the project where, pens down, I become almost a PR person. So I was in New York, in Hong Kong, in LA, and Tokyo, probably within a month or six weeks' time. So there's a lot of travel. Yeah. The beginning of a project, you're working working on vision documents, again, with the creatives. I think my role over time has changed a little bit from more managerial towards working with the creative folks, which is a personal choice. I've enjoyed that. And that's also because we have a very professional management team now. So it used to be that I did a lot with less help, but now we have a very mature management team at Guerrilla.
That's great. So I'm sure that takes a lot of the load off your shoulders.
It does, yeah.
So in those times where you do take a step back and you're not directly involved, is there another way you scratch that creative itch? Do you do things outside of work that are fun for you on a creative level?
For a while, I felt that I was, so my workload was kind of fragmented too much. And you probably recognize that you're responding to so many emails, and a lot of your day-to-day tasks consist of, 3 to 4 minute things where you don't really get to write a piece, or you don't get to. I actually picked up, I did a full degree in philosophy a few years ago.
Really?
Because I just felt like writing stuff and writing essays, and so that addressed that itch. And that's what I needed to do at the time. And now I'm actually more involved. So our structure changed a little bit. We now run the creative process with a narrative director, an art director, game director, myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually more involved in the creation part, which I enjoy.
That's really cool. That's very cool. So what outside influences do you think have helped you in that creative process?
Probably actually a lot of the internal stuff. I mean, I've worked with great game designers and great art directors and now with fantastic narrative directors for so long that I'm more comfortable being part of the process probably. But also, you know, if you've done something for, I don't know, since 2000, your role will have to change over time. Otherwise, yeah, you get bored. How's that for you, Ted?
Well, my role has definitely changed as well. I don't create assets for the games anymore. I used to a long time ago. And then we ended up hiring artists and programmers who are much better than I am. And today, I feel lucky if I can provide some design feedback or a level of detail feedback that will help in some way. But I feel like in general, my goal is to ensure that the transparency is being maintained with what we do across the company, that we are creating things that assets and gameplay that meets the bar that we have set for a particular project, and that people are not running into roadblocks to creativity. I think really that's my main job at Insomniac, is to ensure that if you are in a creative role, which is just about every single person in the company, you aren't stymied by politics or indecision or lack of knowledge. And those are all roadblocks that pop up constantly. And it's my job and our management team's job to knock them down so we can actually be effective at what we do. But it is a constant battle. And we're always learning how to do it better. And that's the fun part about being in the industry. And I'll throw it back to you. Do you feel like you are still learning about better ways to engage in this process?
I mean, completely. This last project that pushed me so far out of my comfort zone without learning a lot, I don't think, and that's not just for me, that's for the entire senior team at Guerrilla Games. I don't think we could have ever pulled it off. So yeah, we're constantly reaching out, going to conferences. It's super important, particularly when you're no longer 23. You know, I'm 47 now. We're learning a lot from people in their early 20s that we hire.
Right.
Actually, the hiring is I hire everybody. I interview everybody that gets hired at Guerrilla. Meeting new people that grew up probably in a different digital age than I did is super important. I got to keep an open mind.
I totally agree. I mean, I think the perspective of the folks who are joining us at Insomniac today are very different than my perspective when I started it 23-24 years ago. And it is really eye-opening to hear somebody say, well, these aren't my influences. This is how I think, and these are the things that I grew up with, and it's a totally different world. And for me, that's the beauty of being in this industry. We have a great mix now of people who are younger, older, diverse cultures, obviously both genders. And I see more and more that these influences are combining in interesting and different ways, as long as we're willing to listen to each other. And sometimes that's a challenge, because those of us like you and me who have been in the industry for a long time have a very, we grew up with certain influences and we have a very distinct way of designing games, but being open to these new ideas is crucial. And I feel like what you were talking about today with your collaborative design process is something that I think should inspire a lot of developers when it comes to how we create our games and how we build our features. I know it's something that we try hard to do at Insomniac. We don't always succeed, but if we aren't collaborative and we aren't listening to everybody, I think we become irrelevant. And the games that we make won't have an audience. And as I look ahead, let me ask you, as you look ahead to where the AAA industry is going, what kind of changes do you see approaching?
You mean organizational-wise, no, team-wise?
I mean IP-wise. I'm getting kind of specific. We're mm-hmm. both making open-world games at this point. We're making Spider-Man, you're making Horizon Zero Dawn, and there are a lot of open world games, and we've made this big shift into a very different type of game that's dominating the market. Mm-hmm. What do you see in terms of the evolution of that genre? What do you see in terms of what's coming next for the big experiences that console gamers are looking for?
Well, what I've noticed recently is that we get a lot of great feedback on taking creative risks. And of course, it's easy for me to say that now after having shipped this game, but it pays off to do something that's very different. So I would encourage AAA studios to think out of the box and to take a gamble sometimes. And I understand, you know, obviously the business side of it. You know, sometimes you can do it, and sometimes you need to earn the right to be given such a big chance. But for us, it took some guts to create a product that is really that had kind of like a deeper a yearning for meaning, if you will. As our teams become more diverse, you know, not just you know, the gender, nationalities, etc., but also older people. Mm-hmm. On the team, you know, we have some devs now in their 50s that we didn't used to have 10 years ago.
Right.
I think there's a lot of appetite for creating more meaningful stories, and you know, the fact that things are open world, so many things have an open world aspect to them. That in itself is not a game changer. The bigger change at Guerrilla has been this kind of a very positive outlook and more meaning. That's what the team has been yearning for.
Yeah. I mean, you can see that in Horizon Zero Dawn. I mean, the story's great, and you're compelled by the main character. So that, I think you're exactly right, because otherwise open world games become cardboard, you know, facsimiles of reality. And we want, as players, we want to be engaged. We want to be emotionally engaged, even though we're exploring these giant, seemingly unending worlds. We want a reason to stay in these worlds. So,
and the other part is that, you know, it's brutal out there. Games are really, really good. There are many really great teams out there. So whereas in the past you could compete on graphics or on technology, now your technology needs to be good, your graphics need to be amazing, your story better be good, you better have a really inspiring character. Everything needs to be solid. And then on top of that, some parts of it should be very original as well. Which is great, because we need to be good at what we do. So the
and I think we need to be pushed. I think that the industry and the audience continues to push our companies harder and harder, but that's great because that promotes growth. Professional growth, team growth, company growth. And I think that's generally why we got into this industry. I'll speak for myself. I love the idea that this industry continues to change and that we can learn more and get better at what we do. And when I look at the artists and designers and programmers at Insomniac, that's what they want too. They want to be better. They want to be masters of their craft. And obviously we can never achieve mastery, but we can get closer and closer with every game we make.
Yeah, we're enjoying the process of trying.
Exactly. So let me ask you one final question. Looking back at all your years at Guerrilla, do you have a moment that stands out as the defining moment for you, a favorite moment?
You know, it probably was E3 2015 when we announced Horizon Zero Dawn. I was debating whether to say this one or when we announced Killzone 2, also at E3. But I would actually still pick Horizon because of the surprise that people just were not expecting it. It was so different. People liked what they saw, but they were just taken aback by how different it was. And you guys are doing that? Really? The disbelief, that's probably been one of my favorite moments at Guerrilla Games.
That's fantastic. Well, Herman, thank you.
No, thanks for the chat.
It's been fun.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.